Good afternoon. I'm Wayne Green. I'm the editorial pages editor of the Tulsa World, and it's a pleasure to be here with you today. It's good to see a good crowd here to talk about Henry Bellman. Back when I had brown hair, I was a reporter for the state, for the Tulsa World State Capitol Bureau, and I got to cover the last 6 months of the Bellman administration, which was a good lesson in integrity that prepared me for the next 4 years of covering state government. We've got a great panel here. It's remarkable how much wisdom and history we have sitting here before us. This will be a wonderful day. Panelists, quick word about our process here. I will introduce each of you, and then I believe the agreement is that you'll have 5 to 10 minutes to discuss your thoughts about Henry Bellman, especially as to his legacy to the state. Mr. Blatt is on the front row with a clock and some white signs, which you may not be able to see in the light. But at the point that you have 2 minutes left in your 10 minutes, he will hold up the two-minute sign, and the time that they're getting ready to get the hook and pull you off the stage, he will hold up the wrap-up sign, and then a bell will go off, and that's probably the last sound you will hear. Lee Payden, would you like to go first? Let me introduce you.
Sure, that'd be great.
Lee Payden is an attorney here in Tulsa. He was an insider in the Bellman administration, an advisor to Senator Bellman on energy and environment, Native American issues especially. For 20 years, he served as the state capital voice of PSO, and now he's an attorney here in Tulsa. Lee, tell us what you think we need to know about Henry Bellman.
Okay. Thank you, Wayne. I appreciate the opportunity to appear today. I must tell you that I keep a watchful eye on the Oklahoma Policy Institute. They happen to be on the same floor in the building that we both occupy, and so I try to keep them out of trouble, Wayne. Most of the participants in this program have some memory of who Henry Bellman was. But today, we want to share with you some of our experiences and hopefully provide you with what, the why, the how, and that truly made him an Oklahoma statesman. It's important to note that Governor Bellman often used his humor in making public appearances, speeches, press conferences, et cetera, and he made a familiar response after being introduced that went something like, "Now I know what a stack of pancakes feels like after the butter and the syrup have been poured over them." So in honoring his legacy today, each of us are going to pour a little bit of syrup on this subject. And saying that, I will tell you that his humility drove the fact that he didn't want things named after him. He didn't want that kind of recognition. And that came from the fact that he was born in Oklahoma, a graduate of Billings High School, Oklahoma A&M, which is now Oklahoma State. And he didn't stray far from his roots. He grew a small wheat farm into a major farming operation and served during World War II as a Marine tank commander, participating in a number of major incursions in the that finally led to the surrender of Japan in 1945. He came back to his roots with the experience of that war embedded in his soul, becoming a farmer and a rancher operation and developing an operation in Noble County, started his family, but he found a real desire to further his service to his state and his country that he got from being a part of that battle experience. Between incursions, his compatriots would return to Maui after those battles, and he once told me that sitting on that island, he gained an understanding of what service really was and service to his country meant, and he made a pledge that he would continue to do that when he returned home. He became a participant in Republican affairs, ran for the Oklahoma House, as you all have seen, was the state chairman. And one of his duties as state chairman was he had to find candidates to run for office. And he went from one end of the state to the other recruiting candidates to run as Republicans, which was an oddity in the late 50s and early 60s. When the gubernatorial election in 1963 came around, he was trying to find somebody to run for governor, and after a bunch of cajoling, begging, pleading with prospective candidates, the Republican leaders just convinced him that he was the only one who could run, and so he did. So his campaign began across the state with his wife and his three kids, three daughters, and ultimately he was elected as Oklahoma's first Republican governor. Subsequent to that, was elected to the U.S. Senate for two terms and returned to Oklahoma and was elected again as a governor in 1986. Today we honor his memory and have been asked to discuss his legacy. And so I decided the best place to go for trying to figure out what a legacy was to look in the dictionary, and Webster says that a legacy is something that's handed down or received from the past and identifies values, philosophy, and gifts as three of the major elements. The best way to sum up, in my view, his legacy is in his own words. The Life and Times of Henry Bellman is a book that he wrote in conjunction with his daughter, Pat. And if you haven't had an opportunity to read it, I would suggest that you do, because it's very good. It's a very good source to give you additional background. But he said this: "My own career has shown that it's not necessary for an individual to be rich, handsome, eloquent, famous, brilliant, charismatic, or clairvoyant to be elected and serve in high public office. What seems to be necessary is a common touch, a closet free of skeletons, an abundance of energy, the ability to communicate clearly and directly, a supportive family, and a wealth of friends. A refusal to be cowed by long odds helps a bunch, as does a sense of humility and a thick skin." As Oklahoma's first Republican governor, Bellman's election didn't create a groundswell of change in the makeup of Oklahoma politics. When he was elected governor, the legislature that was elected at the same time contained 155 members, 119 in the House, and only 25 of those were Republican. There were six Oklahoma state senators out of 46. Those aren't very good odds. In fact, his first major program, which was called Giant Stride, was a program to fund the very thing that Mayor Bartlett talked about, funding roads and other special projects and essential state services, and it went down like a rock. But successes did occur in that term. For example, his first term was also corresponded with the change in the civil rights movement that created a lot of havoc and unrest in the South. And while Oklahoma is not a Southern state, Oklahoma was considered a Southern state because of its segregation. We had segregated schools, eating places, and other vestiges of the Old South. What happened is that Governor Bellman took the tack that you needed to go behind the scenes and negotiate with the key civil rights leaders in the state and develop a way to do the changes that had to come peacefully and without violence and or any kind of major unrest or civil disobedience. And that was successful. On the legislative scene, the Bellman administration also was successful, got one of the first major statewide teacher pay raises passed before he left office in 1967. But more importantly, when he left with the admiration, respect of Oklahoma people who recognized that he had done a good job. In 1968, he decided to run for the Senate. Again, he was running against a 30-year incumbent, but he won that election, and he served two terms from 1969 to 1981. I was fortunate enough to be one of the first team of people who went to D.C. with Senator Bellman. And he was elected in November, and he took office in January. And at Christmas, I got a package. It was delivered to my parents' front door, no name, no, wrapped in Christmas paper. And on Christmas Eve, I unwrapped the package, and it was a pair of cowboy boots. And in, excuse me, in that, in one of those boots was a note that he had written, and it said, "Remember where you came from." And I thought, man, this is going to be a ride. So how many of you people in this room have been to a casino in Oklahoma? Probably a few of you. One of the reasons that you are able to go to Indian casinos in Oklahoma is because Henry Bellman, in 1969, introduced a bill that returned tribal leadership to the members of the tribe. And that bill passed, and the five tribes' leaders are now elected, and their legislative bodies are elected by the membership of the tribe. Before that, the president nominated and sent those names to the Senate, and the Senate approved them. He served as the ranking member of the Senate Budget Committee, and with our budget not being in great shape, you probably wonder, well, that wasn't a very big deal, but it was a big deal and continues to be a major process that tries to keep the budget in hand. The principles that were developed of a working and workable budget process still exist, and hopefully as we progress we'll see those things come to fruition again. Two other examples in the Senate involved an individual that he met in western Oklahoma who had been harassed continuously for years by the IRS, and this man had some of the same characteristics. He just couldn't. He knew he didn't do anything wrong, and he just couldn't let that go. And so he continued to appeal and appeal and appeal. He finally won his case, but there was no way to recover the costs associated with that. And Bellman was able to get an amendment drafted and prepared to allow some recovery. David's signaling me that I don't have very much time, but I want to get this point across because I think it's really important. After that vote occurred and that amendment passed, I was really upset because a Democratic senator who was his good friend had introduced the amendment, said everything there was to say that about the amendment that Senator Bellman would have said. It passed unanimously. It was added to the tax code. It's still a part of the tax code today. And I was kind of going off on the way back to the office after the session was over about the fact that Senator Jackson stole his amendment. And he said, "Lee, let me tell you something that's really important." He said, "It's not that you get your name on something, it's that you get it done." Just you know, fantastic advice, which I've lived by. Other in the panel are going to talk about his accomplishments as governor. I want to say just a little bit about 1017 because it's really an important issue. Had he not had the ability to stick to his principles and his ideals, that would have never happened. And we have been better off by having it in place. The values, his philosophy, and his gifts are truly the legacy of this statesman. His rural values, which he dearly held to, he felt like he was rejuvenated every time he came home. Working together to get things done, his humility, his problem-solving skills, and his accomplishments are all the reasons that he really was a great statesman and is the legacy he's left. In doing his best, upholding his ideals, he was able to communicate a paramount value. Henry Bellman had a rhythm of humor. He had a rhythm of integrity. He had a rhythm of problem-solving skills that played a key role in getting the job done and using those elements to support or oppose an issue. And the tenacity to accomplish his objectives are truly the hallmarks of the legacy he left. Thank you very much.
Fascinating. Senator Williams, are you ready?
Okay.
Let me introduce you. Senator Williams, Senator Penny Williams, served 24 years in the Oklahoma State Senate, representing Tulsa. When she left office, no woman had ever served longer in the Oklahoma legislature. While she was there, she left her imprimatur on practically everything of importance that happened in those 24 years, including she was a co-author of the previously mentioned House Bill 1017. She wrote the legislation that created the University Center at Tulsa, now OSU Tulsa. And as I say, just about everything else that happened in that period had her fingerprints either quietly or on the front end of. Senator Williams, welcome today,
thank you.
We're glad to hear your thoughts.
Mostly behind the scenes, I will say. Henry Bellman was so right about being able to get something done if you just didn't have to get all the credit. You know what? I think that all of you know 1017 is the landmark education reform bill in Oklahoma. I'm sure after your sessions before this, so we're not just talking alphabet soup when we talk 1017, right? You all know what 1017 that it's code for education, strengthening Oklahoma's commitment to education. 1017 is code for that, and that is, to me, the long-lasting legacy from Henry Bellman. So it's an easy one-sentence answer to a much larger question, and there's so much more we can add to it. But I will say to you, students, who obviously have come through a process to get here, that you understand something of excellence, and this, I love props, and this was a button I would have worn if I'd had the Henry Bellman excellence button. Now, Lee tells me he has about 1,000 in his garage, so he's going to give me some for any time I appear the next time. But he is the one who brought this word, and I remember Steve Lewis, who was Speaker of the House, who said, this has got to be the meaning of my administration. Steve Lewis, because I was always talking about quality, said to me, what is quality? What is excellence? What does it mean? Give me an example. Well, I can tell you the result. And that was 1017. That bill, that one bill, established a whole foundation for education. We made plenty of mistakes in that bill. But here was the big reform measure and the money to pay for it. And the Republican Party was a changing roller coaster to work with for Henry Bellman. He spent all of his time talking to Republican legislators. He really did. He also spent a little time talking to Bob Collison and Steve Lewis, and I was privileged to be a witness of a few of those conversations. So I saw from the inside what happens when Sandy and Andrew were working in the governor's office. I had a parallel view from the inside. Well, we appointed this Task Force 2000, and the governor and the speaker and Bob Cullison, president pro tem, got together and appointed this task force chaired by George Singer in, I think it was 2 months. I mean, it was Henry Bellman called a special session of the legislature. We were all asked to go home because the task force did not have legislators on it. It had people like you out there. And these citizens came together and brought us recommendations written by George Singer and the committee. And those recommendations basically said, let's look to results. What happens for students? What's effective for students? How do we get student success? Let's go for the outcomes. Let's look at the outcomes in our policy and not all these little itty-bitty rules and regulations, phone metropolitan phone books thick. It's not these little inputs that matter. What matters is the outcomes in students. Are they ready for the next grade? Will they be equipped to go on and go to college or go to technical training or jobs they want? Will they be equipped to vote? Will they know something other than just straight line math and science, which are our shortage areas? So we did a lot of focusing on math and science, but it wasn't exclusive, as Sandy will tell you. We did curriculum. It's the first time we ever had a core curriculum. In 1989, we put a core curriculum in that bill that included things like geography and the arts and what makes our culture a culture. And it was, I think it was probably maybe six large disciplines were in that law for the first time. This was all of Henry Bellman's vision because he had traveled and because he had seen. And here is, David, I'm looking at you. You'll call on me if it's... I'm looking at this picture of Henry Bellman out in his... outstanding in his field, we say. When you think of this broad country and this wide sky and these... this space, this large space, and he could see the whole state, and he could see the world as he knew it. And he thought big. He thought reform and progress should go hand in hand. We shouldn't be fighting each other. We should be fighting for Oklahoma. He believed in state building. And what we were doing was building a state. And it even got down to... things. When I first came on the scene, he put me on this commission that was a state commission to pass the Equal Rights Amendment. That was back in the 70s. And this is a picture of Irma Bombeck and Henry Bellman and Dean Frank Reed at TU. Anyway, I just brought props. And I just love that picture because it's so... told how much he had listened to all of us, especially his wife and his daughters growing up, and knew what was fair and knew what was right. And he and David Bourne chaired that committee, and I thought, oh, that'll be a snap. Sure, I'll be on it. Well, was I ever wrong? But he just dreamt big, so it was just one of his many dreams of what we should have as fairness. And the next thing before that, and I really have to say this is what inspired me to get into politics, was his presence in Iran. He wasn't there sitting for the camera on the backs of camels or anything. He was on dozers and, shovels and hoes and different kinds of equipment, testing it out when... in the Middle East, we were building pipelines in those days in Iran, and he wanted to see every bit of it. And then he and Shirley went to Iran with us and went bargaining in the shops and excelled at that and made a lot of friends for America. Wherever he went, his presence and that big hand Dewey talked about, that that just engulfed us all. So I really think he was my inspiration for running. I don't want to take up time. David's being so polite. And I just have to thank him for all of it, including the Vote No campaign. Because 1017 was not just a bill that we passed finally through a lot of prayer and effort, and I mean it, prayer. Finally, we had some Democrat legislators who said if we do the property tax credit on food, on the sales tax, they'd vote for it. They didn't want to vote for it. They did. They voted for the emergency. And so we passed the bill through Henry's pugnacity, tenacity, and leadership. And then we had the repeal. We were immediately assaulted with pull back. Let's stop all taxes. Let's stop all, practically, let's just stop the government. And repeal 1017 before it's allowed to go into effect. So that was another year and a half fight. But Henry led it all. And he was just a don't say no kind of governor. He was a leader. He believed in investing in this state and paying for it and building this state up and the progress in this state. And that, to me, is his legacy. I'm not going to take any more time.
Superintendent Garrett, you're up at bat now. Let me tell everyone in the room a bit about you. When I first went to the state capitol, my assignment was to keep track of everything that Sandy Garrett did. I did not realize at the same time they took me off the hourly clock and made me a salary employee for a very good purpose because it was more than a full-time job. Sandy Garrett was Henry Bellman's Secretary of Education. She also served in that same capacity for Governor Walters. She was elected state superintendent in 1990, 1994, 98, 2002, 2006. She'd still be in that office, but she chose to leave it on her own terms. We miss you. As Secretary of Education, she was one of the leading forces in writing House Bill 1017. As superintendent, she was the primary engineer in implementing it. I don't think there's any doubt about what you're going to tell us is the legacy of Henry Bellman, but surprise us.
Okay, I'll surprise you first by saying a little bit about our moderator, Wayne Green, because Wayne, I remember you in those days too. And after I was elected state superintendent, Wayne was assigned to cover education and the State Board of Education. And he was just tenacious in his coverage, but he also had a terrible accident during that time. And he came to the office the first time, he was wearing a halo. You remember those?
Wow.
And it went through all that beautifully, and he knows everything that any of us could tell you about this whole process. And so we appreciate the fact that the Tulsa World saw to it to put you in the lead role there. We're proud of you. I want to kind of turn into a teacher for just a moment and tell you more about the book to which Lee and Penny referred. Pat Bellman, in the audience today, has written with her dad something that every student in this room and in this state should read. The first time I kind of scanned it, because I was in office in this big job and, you know, doing a lot of things, and so I read parts of it. This summer I've had the opportunity to read every word of it, and it is just a treasure house of information, not just about Henry Bellman, Governor Bellman, but about this state. And, of course, all the good work he did and his whole career is in this book. And I just want to read something that Robert Henry said about it on the cover. Robert Henry was a dear friend of Governor Bellman, and he wrote the prologue, the preface to this book. And one of the things he said in here that Henry Bellman never shied away from battle. And in this book, he tells his own story about, as he says, giving away the Panama Canal, which was a controversial issue that he took on, and now it's looked more favorably. But he also says this: there will probably never be another Henry Bellman. But for the sake of this country and this state, I hope I'm wrong. That's what Robert Henry said about one of the things he said about Henry Bellman. So students, I hope that you get a copy of this book and read it carefully, because it will give you a wealth of information about this great man. Well, I want to also say that what an honor it was for me to serve in his office with the great staff he had. Andrew and Lee and Penny was there a lot. We thought you were staff sometimes.
I was in-house.
Yeah, in-house lobbyist, okay. But it was also the reason I ran for office. I know Penny said that too. He was such an inspirational person. And you knew when he talked to you that it was going to be with honesty and respect and insight. He was a big reader and had all kinds of ideas. But I want to tell you about the first time I encountered him, actually on a one-to-one. I was in the Department of Education after leaving a teaching job for 15 years, and I had a call. My secretary said, Governor Bellman's on the phone. I thought, well, that must be a mistake. And why would he be calling me? I was then director of rural education, working with OSU on satellite learning and traveling around the state. And so I got on the phone, of course, immediately, and he said, could you possibly come to my office and visit with me about some education issues? Well, of course, I wasn't going to say no. Yes, sir. What time? He said, now. And I was there. This is true. And I remember walking across the lawn between the Department of Education and the state capitol thinking, I think I have met Governor Bellman. I know I met him once in Washington when I was a teacher. We went to invest his office in Washington. But other than that, I'd heard him speak and read and about him. So I went into his office, and there he was. And he welcomed me and said, you know, Dr. Folks, the then superintendent of schools, has resigned, and he is leaving a vacancy there, and he said, it's my duty to fill that vacancy. And I thought, well, how can I help with that? And he said, well, he said, I have a superintendent in mind, and I'd like to see how you feel about him. He named that person, and I said, oh, he's a very competent person, and I like him very much, and so forth. And he said, then I would like to ask you to be in my office as Secretary of Education. I've been watching some of your work, and I like what you're doing for the state of Oklahoma in rural education. And I thought, this has got to be a dream. This has got to be a dream. I wish I had worn a better suit today. You know, you think, all in one day. And I said, well, Governor, certainly I'm so honored that you thought of me. And this was a Friday. I said, could I possibly have the weekend to review what you've just asked me to do? And he went to some more details about the Secretary of Education. He said, well, I want to do something very important for education during this last term of office. And so I laughed, and I said, I will be back in contact Monday morning. That weekend, I happened to be with my mother, who is from Stillwell, Oklahoma, and she and I were taking a trip, and we met in Tulsa, matter of fact, at the airport. And I said, Mother, you won't believe, Governor Bellman called me to his office, and he asked me to serve as his Secretary of Education. Now, my mother said, honey, don't you have a better job than that right now? She did. And I said, well, this is representing Governor Bellman and all education issues. And she said, well, did you tell him you're a Democrat? I said, I did. I did, and he it didn't seem to bother him. And little did I know, Henry Bellman was going to do what was right, regardless of partisan feelings. And certainly I saw that happen. I know after I went to work, you know, I'd been a teacher, and so I think that he liked classrooms. And, you know, Pat, I read in your wonderful book that his mother had actually been a teacher, your mother. And she had actually walked to a schoolhouse banner and back, and but he never got to talk to her about that because she passed away before he got back. And I think in his mind, he thought, teachers, that is the most honorable profession. I got that feeling throughout my service with him. I know also the meeting that we had was important, except for the fact that as soon as I told him Monday, he said, can you come now? So I was on duty right then. And those of you that know Henry Bellman know that he had a great staff. He really did. Andrew was with him the whole time, and Lee was a great advisor, and Penny was a great advisor, but also Lex and Drew Mason and others. It was a real pleasure to work with them. But one thing that Henry Bellman would do that I just was so enamored with, he would, when I would get to work in the morning, and it was pretty early, he would get there earlier, and he would leave little sticky notes on my door that he had written. He would write a lot in sharp pencil, and he would write these ideas. Look on page 6 and 6 of Education Weekly, and this idea might work in Oklahoma. He would actually do that, and apparently he got up in the middle of the night and read. Sometime, I don't know when he did that. But then late in the evening, when 1017 started, and you've heard a lot about it, and I know you talked about it this morning, it was a major issue. And it tried to be started before 1017, before Task Force 2000. Steve Lewis and Governor Bellman and Bob Collison worked very well together. But of course, you know, when you're the leader, you have to make sure the followers of the band are there. And they weren't all there. And all of the ideas seemed to get, you know, thrown by the wayside. Steve Lewis came up with his own plan that also went by the wayside. So I thought this was very brilliant. Governor Bellman and Bob Collison and Steve Lewis said, remember that resolution that we had a few years ago that put together a task force to study education issues? And they activated that. The leader was from Tulsa, George Singer, and many other people, non-public officials, were on that. I remember being asked for input as to who I thought would be good on there, and he said, I'd like to have a Native American person. And I said, how about Wilma Mankiller? And sure enough, Wilma Mankiller became a member of that task force, as well as many other prominent and wonderful people that spent hours looking over 1017. But, you know, one thing about it during that time when the recommendations from Task Force 1017 came forward, and it was very complicated getting even that task force to agree to everything. So then it was rolled out, and there would be all kinds of picky little, you know, we want consolidation, or we don't want consolidation, or we want teacher tenure abolished. Those kinds of things were all discussed, and very, very passionately, I might say. So it was not just an easy deal. And what I can tell you about Henry Bellman, he never gave up on that. And even when his party and some of the Democrats would say no, he would send us all out trying to twist arms. I know the Republicans in those days were in on the fifth floor. And that's not true now, but anyway, that was true then. And so I thought, boy, he's getting desperate. He sent me up to fifth floor. And I said, well, who do you want me to talk to? And he would say, Jed Wright or this and that one. And I did, and I really enjoyed all of that, actually, because you could see that they were earnestly concerned about, of course, their own constituents and so forth. But as we came together, and, you know, if you do your homework assignment, you'll know a lot of this. And he saw that it was going to pass. He could see that coming together. And everybody gave a little. And that was another real strong point with Henry Bellman. He was a compromiser. And you have to do that. You can't be a dictator. You have to be a compromiser and listen to every point of view. He did that. And when it became law, he wanted to sign it in Tulsa and at a schoolhouse. And he did at Marshall School, and I guess that's South Tulsa.
On Peoria.
On Peoria. And in the yard under a big oak tree, he signed House Bill 1017. And in his book, he calls the signing of House Bill 1017 the highlight of his entire political career. So I'm most honored to have known him.
Thank you, Superintendent Garrett. Just to clarify what you were making reference to, Republicans now can be found in the third, fourth, and fifth floors of the state capitol, I think, right? Andrew Tevington, you're an old friend, but I have to say that the submitted biography of you in today's booklet is somewhat less than thorough. Andrew is, as it mentions, an ordained minister, and you might expect more transparency as such. It mentions that he's an attorney, and it makes reference to his civil service career. He was the press secretary for Senator Bellman, and then general counsel and chief of staff for Governor Bellman in his second administration. It does not mention his first career as a newspaper reporter. Over the course of his career, he worked for the second and third greatest newspapers in Oklahoma. But we're glad to have you here anyway. Andrew, take it away.
Well, thank you. I don't know. There we go. As Wayne said, I'm a former retired minister and a former trial lawyer, so I can't sit down and talk. So I'm going to stand up and talk and wander around like I normally do. Henry Bellman was, without a doubt, the most intelligent person that I have ever had the opportunity to work with, the most honest, the most humble, the most of everything that you want to say good about somebody. I want to tell you a couple of stories about him to help you understand more about who he was and what he did. Lee had mentioned the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and that Governor Bellman then tried to do some things informally. Part of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and part that was really at the forefront at that day, not so much in this day, but that was really big when it was first passed, was the requirement that anybody who offered public accommodations like motels and hotels had to provide a room, had to provide service to anybody who came, no matter what their race was. And the concern was that in some parts of Oklahoma, and especially in Little Dixie, that would not happen, that people would be afraid to offer hotel rooms or motel rooms to people of all races. And just as he got together people from the civil rights organizations to talk with him informally about how we're going to get this implemented, he decided that what he would do would be meet quietly with all of the motel owners in Little Dixie. Got them all together in a room, and he said, "This is the law, and we intend to enforce the law, but we expect that you're going to be afraid to do it because you think that the person down the street won't. And so you're going to be afraid that you're going to be looked at differently by the people in your community than those who refuse to rent a room to whoever comes in. Let's agree here and now in this room that we will all abide by the law. And he actually got all the motel owners in Little Dixie to agree that they would abide by the law, and there was never a problem anywhere in the state of Oklahoma as far as public accommodation in motels. One of the legacies, I think, of Henry Bellman is the way that the civil rights movement worked in the state of Oklahoma. One of his tools in helping to get the civil rights movement to work here was to recognize not everything was about the law. Not everything was about power. A lot of things were about personal relationships. A lot of things were about just talking to people and recognizing the issues that they had and helping them to overcome those issues. There was also, as you can imagine, talk about 1017. And 1017 helps us to understand that Henry Bellman never thought of politics as a dirty word. For him, politics was the art of accomplishing good for the society as a whole. Today we think of politics and we have all these horrible thoughts about it, about dirty money and power and all these other kinds of things. Henry Bellman saw that there were two kinds of politics. There was the politics that was required to get elected, and there was the politics that was required to govern. And they are not the same. They are completely different. 1017 showed his understanding of the politics of governing. Because what happened was, we were meeting, and he said he really wanted to do something for education, that education was in very dire straits in the state of Oklahoma, and that the biggest thing that education needed was an infusion of money. Said reform was important, but money was more important, because we were spending, I think at the time, 49th in the nation per capita, per student, on education. And we were about to be overtaken by Mississippi. And he thought that an infusion of cash was really important to attract good teachers and to keep good teachers as well as administrators, and to provide the things like video conferencing for education in rural areas and that sort of thing. And so he said, what we're going to do is we're going to call a special session so that we can focus on education. And the normal way that a governor calls a special session is the governor talks to the leadership and says, we'd really like to do a special session, and here's what it's going to be about. And Governor Bellman said, we're not going to talk to the legislature about it. We're not going to talk to the leadership, because if I talk to them about it, they're going to say, we don't want a special session. Let's do that later. But if I, a Republican governor, call a special session all about education and produce a bill that is about the reform of education and funding education, the Democrats can't kill the idea. They can't look bad and make it look like a Republican was willing to do something, but they couldn't get it done. So what we have to do is we have to come up with a bill that is a good bill, will do wonderful things for education, most importantly, fund education the way it should be funded, get it introduced, call the special session, get it introduced, and then we're going to see our bill go down. Because they're going to be mad about it. They're not going to like it. But they can't not do something. And so we did. We called the session, introduced the bill. The bill went down in flames. It got one vote. And that was just the author. It was horrible. But the legislative leadership said, we have to do something. And we did all kinds of things. I have to give a lot of credit to Steve Lewis for all the hard work that he put in to trying to figure out how to make this work. And Bob Cullison as well, as they had to work really hard to get this done. But I think the real answer to it all was Task Force 2000 and what happened from there. But Bellman saw what he thought the need was, and he saw that there was a way to get there. It wasn't necessarily the way that was going to win him the most votes. It wasn't the way that everybody was going to point to him and say, what a great guy. I can't tell you how many times when we were in the Senate and I was his press secretary, and I would say, Senator, we've done these wonderful things. We need to put out a press release to tell everybody what you've done. And he would always say, oh, we don't need to do that. Because, you know, if it works, there'll be credit to go around for everyone. And if it fails, they'll know who to blame. I could never get that guy to do a decent press release that tooted his own horn. It just wasn't in him. Then I want to talk about one more thing, and I'm not sure how much I've got to wrap up. Okay. One more thing, and that's the Panama Canal. Lee alluded to his service in World War II with the Marines. And Lee was actually, he went back to the island of Kauai, not to Maui, but that's okay. We'll forgive you for that one. But the Marines did their training on Kauai before they would go off to places like Iwo Jima or Saipan or wherever for the invasion of that island, then come back to Kauai, do more training, then be sent out to another island-hopping invasion. And he said that the most amazing thing to him was that as he would go to these islands for invasions, he was shooting all these Japanese people, and there was all this conflict going on. And then he would come back to the island of Kauai, and everybody there looked like the people he had just been shooting. And that when they went out at night, when they got leave, and they would go to dance halls, the people that he was dancing with were all Japanese women. And he was being invited to the homes of Japanese Americans for dinner. And he recognized that they were all very much like he was. And that the problem was not people. The problem was governments. Governments cause war. People don't cause war. And he vowed at that time that he would get into politics. And he vowed that he would not forget the lessons that he had learned as a Marine on the battlefront and the cost, not only to himself and to his fellow soldiers, but to everybody else. So that when the vote came for the Panama Canal, that memory was foremost in his mind. And I remember as we were discussing the Panama Canal and what he thought he was going to do, he asked the general, who at that time was the governor of the Panama Canal zone, to come in and talk with him. And he asked this general, if we don't ratify the Panama Canal treaties, what do you think will happen? And he said, there'll be a war. And Governor Bellman, or Senator Bellman, then said, can we win? And the general said, in order for me to keep the canal open, I will have to post soldiers virtually shoulder to shoulder along the entire route of the canal on both sides. And then, I can't guarantee it, because all it takes is one mortar to shoot out from the jungle somewhere and to hit one ship in that really tiny canal, and it will be closed. Said, I'll be able to clean it out. I'll be able to get it going again. But the truth of the matter is, it will take so much time for us to win this, because it's going to be a war of attrition. It will take so much time that Congress and the American people will lose their will to continue the battle. And Bellman said he was not going to put American soldiers in that kind of situation. And that's why he voted to ratify the Panama Canal treaties. I think it's important to have people in office, and probably part of his legacy is that he cared about the people that he was supposedly governing. He cared about them, not so much about getting reelected. In fact, he really disliked anybody who would speak to him about what was the politically popular thing to do. He said, that makes no difference. What's the right thing to do? Thanks.
Great.
We've reached that point in our program where we're going to take some questions from the audience, which presents a bit of a challenge unless we turn up the house lights just a little bit, because I can't see you. What I'd like to do is, if you have a question, raise your hand or perhaps stand up. Let me recognize you. State your question. I'll direct it primarily to one of our members, unless you wish to do so, and I will try to repeat the question so that the panelists have a chance to think about an answer, and so that everyone has a chance to hear it. But while you're coming together with some questions there, let me get things rolling with the first one. Lee, perhaps you could answer this one best. Friday is the 40th anniversary of the resignation of Richard Dixon. And a great story in Governor Bellman's memoir is about being among the last group of Republican congressmen who Richard Nixon called in to consult before he spoke to the nation and resigned. Is that a story you can repeat for us?
Well, I can repeat parts of it. I was there when Watergate occurred. I moved back to Oklahoma because he was getting ready to run for re-election at the end of 1973. And so many of the hearings had not commenced. But he was back and forth, not weekly, but a couple of times a month during that time. And one of the things that I did as a staff member in Oklahoma was I drove him to various things that he was
going to appear at luncheons and colleges and a variety of different things. And I'll make this short. But he talked about that a lot. It was really weighed on him tremendously. And when President Nixon finally decided that he could no longer govern, he did call. I believe there were 8 members, and they were senators and representatives as well, to the White House, and told them that he was going to resign the next day. And it was a very, very sad occasion. These were people who had worked with him. Nixon, believe it or not, had accomplished a great deal. He opened the doors to China, as one example. There was a huge problem with the economy when Nixon took office, and he was able to at least control that. It didn't get any worse. But these were all people who had invested themselves in his administration as well. And so while it wasn't an honor to be there, it was a privilege to be there. And that it was a privilege to know that the president thought enough of him as an advisor to ask him to come, and he went. And that's really about, there were some private exchanges and stuff, which I won't go into, but you're talking about the only president of the United States who's ever resigned, and he was a part of that. And so.
Thank you. So, thank you for turning the lights up. Any questions out here? Right here. Okay, so to repeat the question, Superintendent Garrett, what lessons can you take from the fight for 1017 into the current day, including the atmosphere surrounding the debate over the Common Core?
Thank you, Ann. Nice to see you, too. And before I answer this question, if I may take one point of privilege here and recognize Kyle Dolum, former president of the Oklahoma Education Association, during this time that we're talking about when all this was created, and she played a big role in bringing teachers, thousands and thousands of teachers, to the Capitol. And that even helps me get to your question, Ann, in the fact that I believe Common Core and other things like that, outcome-based education, things like that, have to have a lot of communication with those frontliners, the people in the classroom, the parents. And I don't believe that kind of communication happened. I didn't see it, at least from my vantage point. I think communication is just key when you're making any change and implementing it. Now, of course, with 1017, some of those reforms have gone by the way. Here again, you have to communicate the issue to generation after generation. New people are there. None of the people that were there are there because of term limits mainly, but other reasons too. And so I think the communication, keeping it open, is just key, and I don't think it was.
Sandy, let's drill into that just a little bit more. I realized while someone was speaking that 1990 was 24 years ago, and there's a lot of people in the room who are less than 24 years old. So tell us a little bit about the drama of passing 1017 in 1990, and give us an outline of what it included. I'll start. It had a 1 cent sales tax increase that was dedicated to public schools, so a 33% increase in the state sales tax dedicated to public schools. Where did that money go, and what did it do?
That's a good question. It'll also help maybe answer Ann's question. A foundation of curriculum was called for. The first statewide curriculum, as Senator Williams said. And so it was up to the Secretary of Education, as I recall, to appoint a leader to lead a committee that would start developing that. And I appointed Nancy O'Brien, esteemed curriculum researcher at Norman, to lead that effort. That was part of it. But that was a big part because that led to the first
assessment of what you're teaching, of your curriculum, so statewide assessments. It also included not teacher tenure, really, but it broached on that issue. A lot of that discussion didn't make the law. But then the other thing, that voluntary consolidation. And I believe that came from Senator Gardner of Norman. And his advice was to take rainy day money, I believe it was $50 million, to start voluntary consolidation. And the first one was in Nowata County, Lenape, Juan, and one other one.
Taiwa?
Anyway, to become Oklahoma Union. And that was a model that it started. It started really early childhood. And that goes unnoticed to a lot of people. But it did have the elements of early childhood. And I'm not sure if you went over the bill earlier. There were very many, and Penny, you might want to help me here, elements that I'm missing out on. Certification.
Well, one was teacher certification, yeah. Alternative certification, and we got that wrong. That was one of those things we had to come back and fix. So every year, this foundation that Henry Bellman built gave us something to work on because, as Sandy says, it wasn't all just perfect, but we got in there in the beginning the idea of funding early childhood and early childhood development for four-year-olds with high standards for teachers is what ended up. But we had Office of Accountability that was supposed to keep track of all of these things in answer to Wayne's question.
Well, and the biggest thing was our teacher pay for beginning teachers. That was really
the
beginning teacher was making about $15,000 then, $15,300.
And that might have been... We might have been 50 in the United States. No, on
we were very
salaries.
Close to it if we were not. And that really helped drive the momentum because everyone that I talked to believed in that. They all believed that our teachers needed to make more money than they were making.
Reading Sufficiency Act.
Right.
You know, that followed.
That followed it.
The reading, the early reading, and then Herb Rosell put in the amendment to get the teacher aides for children who were disadvantaged to get aids in those classrooms. I mean, there were so many things. But I'll let Lee add on.
Yeah, I was just going to add that another thing that really made 1017 a success was that Governor Bellman went to the business community and he said, if we're going to have students who are going to excel and who are going to be your employees in 5 to 10 years, we've got to have reform in education. And the business community coalesced around 1017, spent literally millions of dollars in the process of getting the referendum passed because they recognized that without true reform in education, that this state was going to lag behind in a whole variety of things, including recruitment of new business in the state, of keeping businesses that were here in the state, and that was a key element in getting the referendum passed as well.
And, of course, the Tulsa World will give them credit here because they sure deserve it. Tulsa community, this community was on fire for 1017. Unfortunately, that wasn't the case in Oklahoma City, albeit they did come around to some of the issues. But it really is a long laundry list of things that are interlocking and interwoven, and it started a ripple effect, as Senator Williams said, of many other things to come that either corrected or built upon it. But the magic to it was all paid for. And that was what had to happen.
Yeah. Great question. Who has another? Senator Williams and Andrew, I'm going to let you both have a crack at this. Let's see if I can repeat it.
I have two quick things I'd love to say.
Sure.
First is, thank you, David. You are a hero of mine, just in the same way that Henry Bellman is. You tell the truth. And I thank you so much. I thank you for the work you do, and you and Vince, and the wonderful work you do in telling us the truth.
What? Stop dodging.
Bringing us the reality. You do. That's part of what you do. I think Henry Bellman would... Have you ever heard David Bourne...
Oh, yes.
...give a speech about a tax increase for whatever it is we're doing in medical education or wherever it is at OU? I think that Henry Bellman would be doing the same kind of thing when I think of those two co-chairmen of that committee. I think he would... What they do is to make you almost feel unpatriotic for not believing enough in your state to pay for improving our commitment to education. I mean, they make... Henry Bellman did it, and David Bourne does it. And I think that Henry, you might disagree with that, would do something not to attract attention so much, but to absolutely insist. And I am a witness because I know he was getting ready, and Kyle Dahlem can attest to this, he was getting ready to be the catalyst for a new movement for excellence in education, value-added excellence in education, progress in education. Go ahead. Tell
Andrew,
me I'm wrong.
Let me turn the question around just a little bit. I'm not sure that anyone in the room completely understands the nature of the Republican Party prior to Henry Bellman. The way a small group of very wealthy men would meet in a tall building in Tulsa and decide who the next Republican governor candidate would be, not that it mattered. Tell us a little bit about how he re-engineered the two-party system in Oklahoma.
Well, part of it, when you look at the Republican Party of the day before he took it over, its main purpose was to recommend to President Eisenhower's administration who the postmaster should be in every town. And they weren't really too concerned about anything else. And basically what Henry Bellman did was go around all those people. He literally went to every single county and found people who were interested in doing more than appointing postmasters and created from scratch a Republican Party organization in each and every county so that you then had the organization for the whole state. And that organization was interested in doing things in government, not just talking about how happy they were they found the gubernatorial candidate that they wanted and they knew who was the postmaster. But I think you have to look at some other things. For example, 1964, during the National Republican Convention, that nominated Goldwater as the presidential nominee. A lot of people probably don't recognize Henry Bellman was on the outs with that whole Republican Party. The Republican Party in Oklahoma was very much a Goldwater party, very much Goldwater supporting. But Bellman was still able to work with all those people, mainly because of the personal relationships that he had created with each of them. He told me on a number of different occasions that the most important thing in politics was personal relationships, that those went much farther than ideology. They went much farther than issues in helping to get things done. And so while he disagreed with Goldwater as a candidate, and he was for somebody else completely, even though that was going on, he was still able to work with what I call the dissidents within the party to get things accomplished in other places. Just because you can't agree on everything doesn't mean you can't agree on anything. And he also said on a number of occasions that a mistake that most politicians make is that they identify their base and they never try to do anything to increase the size of that base. And that just preaching to the choir every Sunday was not going to get things accomplished. You had to go out on the streets and you had to find people who didn't know how to carry a tune. And so bring them on in to your base as well. And I think you saw that. I mean, despite the fact that he was called the father of the modern Republican Party in Oklahoma, when you look at his administration, especially that second gubernatorial term, if you look at the cabinet, I believe half of the cabinet was Democrat and half were Republican. And, you know, some of the most important members were Democrat. Sandy was a Democrat as Secretary of Education. Lex Holmes was a Democrat. Hannah Atkins, all in positions that weren't just, you know, window dressing, but positions of some importance.
Andrew, yeah. One other thing about what happened in the 1963 era. The voter registration in Oklahoma was way tilted toward the Democratic Party. And one of the things that they came up with was a program that was based around the Bellman Bells that was called two-party tea parties. And they would go from town to town to town, and somebody, whether they were Republicans or Democrats, would sponsor a tea party and invite their friends, and the girls would be there and their mother would be there, and then he would swoop in usually 45 minutes late. He was never a real stickler for time, but then talk and answer questions and visit with the people who were there. And it was a situation where he was in somebody's home, and it wasn't a Republican home, it wasn't a Democratic home. It was a home where Oklahomans came together, and that kind of philosophy carried forward really throughout his first term, his Senate term, and his second term as governor, and was one of the reasons he was successful.
Yeah, I think another thing to look at, that constantly being open to other people, constantly being willing to compromise. Compromise has come to be a dirty word, which he didn't consider it to be. He saw politics as the art of the possible. And if you get no bread at all, you know, you haven't accomplished anything. So he was willing to compromise. For a long time, I thought that he would have a difficult time today because, let's all face it, Henry Bellman was the worst public speaker that ever existed in politics anywhere.
No.
He was just horrible.
That's not true.
He was also not the most photogenic guy that you would ever see. And so, you know, with all the media stuff, you would think he would have problems. But, and Wayne, you can chime in on this and correct me. But I saw, both as his press secretary in D.C. and then later in the gubernatorial term, I saw that the honesty, the straightforwardness that Henry Bellman brought to his relationship with the media earned him a lot of credit. And so he got from the media much more than you would have thought that he would get.
I would tell you this, that my mentor at the Tulsa World Capital Bureau, Chuck Irvin, who had been the bureau chief since J. Howard Edmondson was the governor, used to, not completely jokingly, refer to Henry Bellmen as the greatest Democratic governor in the history of Oklahoma, which for Chuck was the same as saying the greatest governor in the history of Oklahoma. Okay, you opened a door there that we need to close. In the 64 San Francisco convention, Henry Bellmen was the governor or party chairman?
Governor.
Governor. And, okay, who did he support? Romney, Rockefeller?
Nixon.
He was always a Nixon guy, but I don't think Nixon was running then. I think it was Rockefeller, but I can't swear to that.
All right.
In 1960.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question. Right here.
Tell us about Bellmen and the highway tax.
The highway tax, did you say?
Yes.
Okay. So the question is, tell us about Henry Bellmen and the highway tax. Lee, could you... the Oklahoma highway tax.
Well, first of all, are you talking about turnpikes?
87.
Oh, okay. Andrew, you probably are better to answer
the chief of staff,
than
Andrew. Tell us the details on what happened in 1987.
I can't remember 1987.
Okay. I'm not sure I can either. But thing to know about Henry Bellmen and highways was that he looked at highways and the construction of highways, the rebuilding of highways, as a great economic primer. For a state. He said, you know, the federal government has defense spending that will prime the pump, and states have highway spending that will prime the pump and help to develop the economy and get jobs going. So I don't believe that there was ever a highway construction project that Henry Bellmen didn't love. He wanted to make sure that we built as much as we could, which was why he was such a strong supporter of the turnpikes.
Right. His most abiding highway tax was the cross-pledging of turnpike fees, right. Which perpetuates the turnpike system.
Yeah. And he always wanted to make sure that we continued to build the highways, and saw he frankly saw turnpikes as a better way to do it than using regular tax revenues, because tax revenues dribble in over many, many years. If you look, for example, I'm from Oklahoma City, so Oklahoma City to Norman, you have I-35, and they have been rebuilding that road ever since I moved back to Oklahoma 30-some-odd years ago, because it takes so long. But then you look at things like the Creek Nation Turnpike, the Kirkpatrick in Tulsa, others. I mean, they were built in relatively almost instantly because all the money was available immediately. So that's what he liked. But he always wanted to make sure that we continued to build what we could. And so cross-pledging and everything else was perfect for him.
Our time is up here, I'm sorry to say, because I could listen to this all day. Help me thank the panel here. They're really amazing.